Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Super Committee had its last public hearing 3 weeks ago, at which this testimony was offered by one witness.
I'm worried you're going to fail. Fail the country.
Turns out, he was right. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 21st of November. Good as always to have you with us. And just to be clear here, that witness from the Super Committee hearing 3 weeks ago?
I'm worried you're going to fail. Fail the country.
Yeah, that guy? That wasn't just anybody. It was former White House Chief of Staff Erskine Bowles. He of the Bowles-Simpson Deficit Reduction Commission, so he knows whereof he speaks. Late this afternoon, the two Super Committee co-chairs made it official. No deal, no compromise, no bargain, grand or otherwise. They did it in a written statement, by the way, no press conference. Here's the key phrase from Senator Patty Murray and Representative Jeb Hensarling. We have come to the conclusion today, they say, that it will not be possible to make any bipartisan agreement available to the public before the committee's deadline, which was, or is, I suppose, midnight Washington time. So that means the fate of the federal deficit goes back whence it came, to the whole Congress in an election year. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura gets us going.
Remember where we were just about a year ago? It's December 2010.
Today, President Obama explained his decision to compromise with Republicans on extending tax cuts for everyone, even the rich.
The Bush-era tax cuts extended temporarily.
These tax cuts will expire in 2 years.
Congress will have to grapple with the issue again.
But they didn't. The deal on the debt ceiling last summer created this committee to tackle the deficit Congress couldn't. Michael Linden is director of tax and budget policy at the Center for American Progress.
The major stumbling block has been and continues to be taxes for wealthy people.
The super committee couldn't agree, so now it's back to Congress. But that's just one item on the agenda.
By the end of this year, they're going to have to make a decision about the payroll tax cut.
Some unemployment benefits are set to expire. Ross Baker teaches political science at Rutgers.
Getting any of those reauthorized and passed is going to be much more difficult than it was in the past.
Baker says Congress doesn't have the right ingredients for compromise on a host of expiring tax cuts and benefits.
The second session of the 112th Congress is sort of in the position of somebody who opens up the refrigerator, discovers that all of the refrigerated goods have expired and they've got to throw them out and go back to the store.
And then there are those automatic cuts that are supposed to kick in if the super committee fails. There's already talk of changing those, but who knows if Congress will be able to agree on that. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Should you be of a mind to try balancing the federal budget yourself, we've got a game on our website that'll let you do that. Look for the link that says Budget Hero. See how you do. So I guess you can officially make it two debt crises in the global economy now, ours and Europe's. From the Marketplace European Desk in London, Stephen Beard has that side of the story.
Everyone from the U.S. to China has berated Europe for failing to get its debt crisis under control, so the Europeans may be forgiven for enjoying a moment of relief. At least someone else is in the doghouse as well. But Stephen Lewis of Monument Securities says there's little comfort there for Europe. Its debt problems are still much worse than America's.
The U.S. doesn't need to act as swiftly as the European authorities because the consequences of failure for the U.S. administration are not as dire as they probably will be for the Europeans.
After all, one or more Eurozone governments might go bust and the euro itself could implode. Neil McKinnon of VTB Capital says that isn't going to happen to the U.S.
Ultimately, America won't default because it can issue its own currency, it can print money.
And there's still a global appetite for that money. Even after the Super Committee news, investors piled into dollar assets. But Stephen Bell of the GLC hedge fund says the US is resting on its laurels. It should tackle its deficit now. It should learn from European mistakes.
I'm absolutely certain that people will look back on this year of inaction in the United States and say, yep, we should have done something then. Because when you have to take the pain, as the Italians have discovered, the longer you leave it, the more painful it is.
He says the U.S. still looks in much better shape than Europe, but there's no comfort in that for the U.S. Europe is in very poor condition. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
More than most, the failure of the Super Committee is a story that cries out for context, its proper place in history, if you will. So we've called a history professor. David Kennedy teaches history at Stanford University. It's good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
This notion of our elected representatives, in essence, throwing up their hands and saying, yeah, we can't do this, it seems kind of remarkable. Have we ever been here before? Has this ever happened?
Well, you know, I think it's beyond disappointing. I think maybe a word like disgusting might be more appropriate. And I'm reminded that we're in the presence here of some of the very worst defects of our constitutional system. And it came to mind this morning as I was reading the newspaper accounts of this, recollected Woodrow Wilson's great work written in the 1880s when he was still a graduate student at Johns Hopkins called Congressional Government. And he identified many defects, but two in particular that are so obvious today. He said, first of all, there is just an enormous opacity and lack of transparency to the way that Congress does its business. And secondly, he said, this was the graver, much more serious matter in his view, that the way Congress conducts its business, there is no accountability. That there's 535 different people and they're responsible to different constituencies, and it's very rare when you can get a majority of those people to really take the national responsibility seriously rather than their parochial representative responsibilities.
Well, then why are people surprised or at least feigning surprise that this happened?
Well, I don't know. I, for one, am not surprised. Yeah. I think this was kind of predictable when the budget deal was worked out several weeks back, that this is, to use the phrase that's now become so common, kicking the can down the road.
Yeah,
I guess we're going to kick it again.
Yeah. But, I mean, we assumed best intentions, right? I mean, we all said, okay, they got a budget deal, they're going to go, and we assumed that they would make an honest effort to try to work things out. Were we just wrong?
Yeah, I think people who assumed that were wrong, to be honest. We've come to a stage in this long partisan standoff, this is just the latest episode, that has bled any faith in the Congress from this citizen, that's for sure.
Well, let me ask you this then. Can, first of all, the economy and also our political system take 12 more months of this? Because the line today is, oh, we'll fix it after the election.
Well, we remain a resilient society, I think. So I suppose if we survive things like the Great Depression and World War II and 9/11 and three wars in the last decade, we could probably muddle through this. But in the meantime, we're doing tremendous damage, not just to our own economy and society, but to the global economy. And you add the uncertainty that we're creating and perpetuating to what the Europeans are adding to the equation, and you've got a formula for, I think, a really sizable catastrophe.
Yeah, one wonders if the Europeans are sitting there sort of rubbing their hands and saying, oh, God, finally we're off the front pages.
Well, I don't know if they're off the front pages, but they at least the two countries that have recently gone through the ringer, Greece and Italy, have reached for what the newspapers now call a technocratic solution. That kind of thing's not really available to us. It's not in our culture and our tradition. I mean, when Tom Friedman says, for example, if we could only be China for a day and solve all these problems from the top down and then get on with business, that's a fantasy. We're not that kind of political culture. We don't have those kinds of political institutions.
Well, but then what happens, right? Because this can't go on.
Well, what's the old cliche? If things aren't sustainable, they won't be sustained. So, yeah, there's got to be some kind of a resolution here at some point. But we may pay an awfully big price for an even greater catastrophe before we finally muddle our way through to a solution.
David Kennedy is a professor of history at Stanford University. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
All right, so for the story of the day on Wall Street, forget stocks and look at bonds for just a minute. No debt deal, yet U.S. government debt is more popular than ever. Go figure that one out. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The latest round of UN climate talks is set to start in a week in Durban, South Africa. General consensus is that nothing's going to happen. And the lack of progress at that level mirrors what seems to be a rough patch for a lot of environmental groups. Funding problems, layoffs, and leadership changes, including at the granddaddy of them all, the Sierra Club. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Carl Pope has stepped down after nearly two decades running the Sierra Club. Some on the inside are cheering his departure. Sure, he helped kill 125 coal plants, and he filed the key Supreme Court lawsuit on climate change. But he made enemies by reaching out to big business. Jigar Shah runs the Carbon War Room, and he's a board member at Greenpeace.
Carl presided over a time when corporations really started taking green as a force for green, you know, for profits to the bottom line, very seriously.
For instance, paring back a company's supply chain cuts fossil fuel use, and it saves money. Both sides benefit from working together. But to some, Sierra Club got too close to Clorox, sticking its logo on supposedly green cleaning products.
Carl thought lending their brand would be important to actually giving the millions of people who respect the Sierra Club the comfort that Clorox really had, you know, moved in the right direction. I would not have supported that decision.
But he respects it. The engage or not debates continue, even as more companies like Walmart and private equity titan KKR team up with the Enviro groups. It comes at a time when the nonprofits struggled to raise money the old-fashioned way, through donations. Eileen Clausen is with the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions. She blames
policy fatigue, donor fatigue, and the economy. And I do think foundation funding for work in the climate and energy areas is a lot less than it was when there was a real push to try to get national legislation.
For instance, Clausen's own group was once supported by the Pew Charitable Trusts, but the money ran out. She's filled the gap in part with funding from companies like Hewlett-Packard and Shell Oil. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There's a certain catch-22 that weak economies bring, especially when it comes to helping people in need. Because just as the demand for social services rises, the resources available to provide those services dries up. From New Hampshire Public Radio, Dan Gorenstein reports that a lot of food pantries and soup kitchens are facing rising food prices and a drop in charitable giving.
Christopher Persall started to notice changes at his local soup kitchen earlier this summer. More and more, he says, he's getting less and less.
So now, instead of being able to get food every day of the week, we can only get food 2 days out of the week. And once a month, we can go on Monday. And that's by itself shows you how much it's changed.
Persall works occasional landscaping jobs. He, his wife, and their two-year-old son live off food stamps and whatever he can get his hands on at the soup kitchen in Nashua, a small city in southern New Hampshire. Since July, demand here has doubled, and it's getting less food from one of its main suppliers, the New Hampshire Food Bank. In response, the staff is limiting how often people like Persall can pick up carrots, potatoes, and bananas.
And it's dwindled down to the point where it's almost upsetting to people that have been coming here for a long time.
The organization Feeding America runs 200 food banks around the country, providing staples to 61,000 soup kitchens, shelters, and pantries. Since 2008, the group has seen annual increases in the amount of food it delivers. But this year, spokeswoman Maura Daly says Feeding America is projecting no growth in the food it distributes.
It means that the need is outpacing our ability to keep up with it.
The problem boils down to a matter of resources. On the one hand, charitable donations to food banks have dropped. The New Hampshire Food Bank, for example, has seen business and corporate giving plummet 45% over last year. At the same time, food prices are rising, stretching budgets of food assistance programs across the country.
I think they're up maybe 4-6% this year after and projected to be up maybe another 3% next year.
Ken Kupchick is the development director for the River Valley Food Bank in Fort Smith, Arkansas. Last year, $1,000 bought 40 cases of tuna. This year, it nets him 32. The price of turkeys also shot up more than 20%, putting a crimp in Kupchick's Thanksgiving plans. He found a producer in Pennsylvania selling the birds for a good price, 93 cents a pound. But of course, there was a catch.
There will be a leg missing, the wings might be missing, or something like that.
These are so-called aftermarket turkeys, which have been damaged during processing.
They'll be awkward. Awkward turkeys.
The symbolism isn't lost on Kupchick. He says the iconic image of prosperity and abundance, a plump golden brown turkey, is being pushed aside.
It's hard to imagine that this is our new Norman Rockwell image of America.
Kupchick says even with the great deal, this Thanksgiving, he can't even afford the damaged birds. In Concord, New Hampshire, I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up, what happens when the boom goes bust?
We lost roughly 17 to 18% of all of our jobs, which is a huge hit.
Southern California's inland empire. But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, then. Here you go. The Dow Industrials lopped off 248 points today, 2.1%, finished at 11,547. The NASDAQ down 49 points, nearly 2%, closed at 2523. The S&P 500 off 22 points, 1.8%, finished at 1192. All 30 Dow components ended in the red. Boeing, Caterpillar, and Alcoa were each dinged more than 2% today. Hewlett-Packard unplugged 4%, that ahead of its fourth quarter earnings report, the first for new CEO Meg Whitman. Retailers had a mixed start to the week that launches holiday shopping. Amazon shares drained 4% today. Home Depot and Best Buy unloaded more than 2%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note, remember what happened today, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.96%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its second estimate gross domestic product report for the third quarter. To help you eliminate dangerous gifts from your holiday shopping list, U.S. FERC issues its annual Trouble in Toyland report. And on November 22, 1928, in Paris, Maurice Ravel's Bolero was performed for the first time. Now, don't you want to listen to the whole thing? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. In Manhattan yesterday, a man by the name of Theodore Forstman died of cancer at the age of 71. For better or worse, Forstman all but invented the practice of leveraged corporate takeovers, buying companies with borrowed money. He made billions of dollars doing it, but he wasn't always wild about the craze that he helped create. In fact, he's the guy who came up with the phrase barbarians at the gate. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
By now, who isn't familiar with the idea of buying something with other people's money? But back in the 1970s, it was a fresh business plan. Borrow lots of money from big investors to buy up companies, use the revenue to pay down the debt while you fix them up, and then sell for a big profit.
The business model was like alchemy. I mean, it was incredible genius.
William Cohen is an author and magazine writer.
And when it worked beautifully, and nobody made it work, frankly, any better than Teddy Forstman.
Cohen conducted some of the last interviews Forstman gave for a feature due out next week in Vanity Fair. He says even as Forstman prided himself in taking over fix-up companies, he grew increasingly dismayed by the mountains of debt being piled up by Wall Street to fund irresponsible deals. Cohen says unlike the Hollywood image of the ruthless corporate raider, Forstman was widely respected for taking a hands-on approach and turning companies around. They included Gulfstream Aerospace, Dr. Pepper, and most recently the sports and fashion agency IMG. He also gave millions to charity.
You know, he wasn't perfect by any means. He had his enemies, but I think by and large history is going to be very kind to Teddy Forstman.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
This is going to be, as you know, a busy travel week. Lots of opportunities to get through a good book as you fly or ride to wherever you're going. And as it happens, a lot of writers have been thinking about the economy lately, work in particular. So in our commentaries this week, their interpretations of what people are experiencing. First, Pulitzer Prize winner Jeffrey Eugenides.
My father was a mortgage banker. We used to have lots of mortgage bankers at our house growing up. You can imagine how exciting the parties were. I was, you know, used to lots of men in suits discussing interest rates in our living room. So far, I've written mainly about young characters who don't have jobs yet. So I'm just inching into that territory. But recently, I've been writing about young people graduating into the recession of 1982. So I've been thinking about unemployment, especially unemployment when you're young, and how daunting that can be. I actually don't agree with some of the most dire assessments. You know, having graduated myself in 1982, when jobs were hard to get, I don't really agree that it's going to hold down people's, you know, income for the rest of their lives. Every day I'm hearing these terrible prognostications, scaring the living daylight out of young people now. It does get better. You can graduate into the middle of a recession and survive. And I have a little bit of optimism because I can see it in my rearview mirror a bit, and I know that we'll get through it.
The most recent book from Jeffrey Eugenides is called The Marriage Plot. Our series on authors and work continues tomorrow with Barbara Ehrenreich. Send us your thoughts While you wait, marketplace.org, click on the link that says contact. The recession is officially over. A lot of experts and some economic indicators agree on that. But the experts and the indicators don't always know what they're talking about. In California's Inland Empire, that's definitely true. The Inland Empire is out in the desert, east of L.A., with 4.3 million people living there, nearly double the population of Nevada. In the decades before the recession, it was the place families went to pursue the American dream. Cheap suburban houses with two-car garages, and good jobs in construction and trucking. There were so many jobs, in fact, that the unemployment rate fell below 5%. Now it's triple that in a lot of towns out there, and the dream has turned into something of a nightmare. So today, in the first of a two-part series, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman takes a trip to see what the future might hold.
Drive an hour east of L.A. on the freeway, and you come to the town of Rialto, population 100,000. Unemployment is over 16%. 1 in 10 of the modest tract houses here have been lost to foreclosure. Home prices have fallen by two-thirds. Main Street businesses, from restaurants to realtors, have shut down. It didn't used to be like this.
Downtown filled up just before the recession.
I met Rob Steele in his storefront office. He's the Rialto city official in charge of economic development. And his department's been busy, providing services to the city's growing population, up more than 35% over just the past two decades.
We had owners that were reinvesting in the buildings and their businesses, and then it just emptied out almost overnight. Consumers can't buy homes, can't buy goods and services that go with homes. All those things have compounded to make this recession probably the most difficult one since the Great Depression.
And so stepping out from the redevelopment center, you can immediately see that decimation on this Main Street.
There's a closed dry cleaners, a closed upholsterers, an empty beauty salon.
We are in a world of hurt.
That's John Husing, chief economist at the Inland Empire Economic Partnership. And keep in mind, everything he says about the Inland Empire, it looks even worse in cities like Rialto and San Bernardino with their preponderance of lower-income blacks and Hispanics.
We lost roughly 17 to 18% of all of our jobs, which is a huge hit.
Husing says there used to be a lot of growth here, but the engines that drove it have stalled. First, that's construction, which boomed on cheap land and loose mortgages. Then, manufacturing, which benefited from blue-collar workers who came for the cheap housing. Finally, logistics. That's trucking cheap Asian imports from the huge ports of Los Angeles to local warehouses, then onto Walmarts and Targets all over the country. So, what's left for Rialto and the Inland Empire? Let's start with construction. The good news?
People have not stopped having sex in California. We are still seeing a growing population.
The bad news?
We are not creating housing for them. We will have gone through somewhere between 8 and 10 years of no housing creation.
Economist John Husing says construction's down by more than half. That's 70,000 jobs gone missing. And he doesn't expect it to revive until 2018. How about manufacturing? Next door to Rialto is the city of Fontana and one of the largest steel mills still operating in Southern California.
These rolls of steel are as much as 50,000 pounds.
Brett Googe of California Steel.
It's going to be stamped, rolled, cut, shaped.
Primarily for the U.S. market. A lot of that steel production used to go into new housing. About one-tenth of the 1,000 workers at the mill lost their jobs when the bubble burst. Now business is back, thanks to new gas pipelines and solar plants. Googe expects to add 50 workers next year, but these aren't jobs for everyone.
Our mill, like any mill that has survived in the United States, is highly automated, and it takes people who are good problem solvers, who are good communicators, and who have some technical capability.
That could be a problem because this region has one of the lowest education levels in the country. Only 12% of residents have a BA. So what about logistics, moving all those Chinese imports from ship to warehouse? On a dusty four-lane highway a few miles from downtown Rialto, tractor trailers stream into a sprawling FedEx warehouse. The town's tried hard to recruit these employers, and business is up as global trade rebounds and Americans start buying again. good news for warehouse worker Rudy Mendoza. I met him at Sunrise Church, a huge evangelical center in Rialto.
I was laid off for almost a year. Okay, I was collecting unemployment benefits. And just about when it was about to expire, I got a job. Thank God for that.
Mendoza is loading shoeboxes for Converse and taking home less than $20,000 a year. But here's the rub. Another shoe company, Skechers, just opened a high-tech, state-of-the-art facility nearby. Loading and inventory are largely done by robots. The pay is better than at a typical warehouse, but that means there are fewer workers. At the new warehouse, employees hardly ever touch a shoebox. So workers like Mendoza, without the skills to move boxes around robotically, can only hope there'll still be enough work moving them by hand. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We've got some maps on our website where you can see just how bad unemployment is in Southern California's Inland Empire and compare it to where you live. Also, there's a slideshow of some of the towns Mitchell visited for his story for us. Marketplace.org. It's the website.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which the American people are smarter than Congress. We don't cite a lot of polls on this program, but I thought this one was interesting. The Quinnipiac University Polling Institute, which is a pretty widely respected organization, said today 69% of us knew the supercommittee was doomed. More Republicans than Democrats were right. 54% of Democrats said the committee would fail. 84% of Republicans. So go figure that out. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this Monday. Today, the Dow lopped off 248 points, 2.1% on the news of the aforementioned supercommittee. NASDAQ down 49 points, nearly 2%. The S&P 500 off 22 points, 1.8%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Gina Delvac, Justin Ho, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time, back here, when the going gets tough, the tough go to church.
In communities where there are severe financial struggles, they look to the church to provide them help.
Part two of our series about Southern California's Inland Empire. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. Do hope you can join us for it tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.